Ahea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nawe mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 17-829, State v. Medeiros. Arguing for petitioner, Hayden Aluli. Arguing for respondent, Peter Hanano. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Aluli and Mr. Hanano. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Good morning, yes.
All right. Mr. Aluli, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning of 10 minutes to go, and we'll give you a warning of 10 minutes as well. Please.
Good morning. May I please the court? Thank you for considering this case on certiorari review. This case presents the issue of how do you gauge where a trial court abuses its discretion, and in particular this case, in denying deferred acceptance of a no contest plea. I'd like to frame this issue really as like an equal access to justice case. In 1976 and even beforehand, it's been a practice of Hawaii that for first-time situational defendants, a trial court has the discretion to defer accepting a guilty plea and placing a defendant on a term of deferral or probation. And that opportunity is substantial, because if a defendant substantially completes his or her conditions, then the case shall be dismissed.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Lilly, but what statute are you referring to when you say that a dank is available?
It's Chapter 853 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. And in 1976, the legislature incorporated that statute in as the law of Hawaii. And in 1976 up to 1983, I believe, a defendant had to enter a guilty plea in order to invoke the opportunity or benefit of having the chance to have his or her record remain free for the rest of his or her life.
Mr. Lilly, can you address the prosecutor's argument that it's not a dankable offense?
Thank you, Your Honor. This case goes back to State versus Hamili. And with Your Honor, you're a member of the court that handed down Hamili. But I have to say, frankly, I think that case should be revisited and reversed, because I don't think it really can withstand the kind of judicial scrutiny that this court is handing down.
Well, Mr. Lilly, generally speaking, when a court grants a deferred acceptance of guilty plea or no contest plea, it usually requires the defendant to comply with certain terms and conditions that are similar to terms and conditions of probation. Now, how would the court go about doing that in a case that is non-probationable?
Well, I think the court needs to step back and look at the rationale of Hamili. Hamili was out of the Second Circuit. A district court granted or wanted to grant a deferral for a person who was convicted of a Hawaii administrative rule of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, gillnet fishing. And under the rules promulgated by the DLNR, it required for a first offense $100, second offense, I believe, $500. But it basically just had, and it was a petty misdemeanor. So a person could be put in jail for 30 days. Now, Hamili had the fear that because a defendant could arguably keep getting a deferral, that a sentencing court would, he or she would be able to avoid having a conviction under the Dank statute. But I think that fear is greatly misplaced, Your Honor, because the two cases that Hamili relied upon had to do with the prostitution case and had to do with the DUI case, State versus Dahm and State versus Dannenberg. Now, in Dannenberg, it had to do with the DUI statute. The statute in those days, the legislature had said you could not get probation for DUI. Now, with the prostitution statute, the legislature said, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, you shall be sentenced as follows. Now, the Hamili court grabbed on that and said, when you look at the statute, there shall means shall, and you can't get probation under the DLNR statute.
So shall means shall.
Shall means shall.
That's the part that would have to be overruled in your view, because it would seem, it would at least on its face appear to be applicable to the statute here.
Yes. And I think when you look at it, Hamili didn't really look at the general statute, which you can find at 706-605, where the legislature has authorized sentencing courts across the state that it could give probation, could impose fine, and could imprison. But Hamili never addressed that general proposition that the DLNR statute in Hamili didn't specifically take away the power of the court where you couldn't give probation.
Hamili is really quite breathtaking if you look at it. I mean, it sort of all of a sudden decides, based on a deferral, based on a DAG statute interpretation, it eliminated courts from giving a probationary sentence in all petty misdemeanor offenses where the statute is structured in a way where it says you can get jail or a fine. I mean, that is really, not only is it inconsistent, it appears with 706, the face of it, but it's kind of takes away a whole spectrum of authority from a court in sentencing. It's saying it's jail or a fine. We can't, we're eliminating from a court the authority to place somebody on petty misdemeanors. And in fact, if you think about it, since the penal code is uniform, it's only doing that for non-penal code offenses, which is kind of inconsistent with the whole sentencing scheme.
I agree with you, Your Honor. And in looking back at Hamili, it really is a different time in a different court. And I, the only sense I can make of it is there is some type of fear that a sentencing court would give breaks to arguably people fishing. I mean, with all due respect, Your Honor. Because
I think you're just guessing at this point.
I am guessing. But the holding of Hamili said, basically, since the DLNR regulation did not provide for probation, the power of the court was taken away. And I find that stunning.
Why isn't it reasonable to interpret that as the intent of the legislature? In this particular category of resource offenses, that they may feel that particular sentence is more effective?
Well, I think if you look at it from the general, I guess, legislative power and judicial power, I feel Hamili was trying to legislate instead of just be a judicial interpretation of the statute. Because
even
I feel the statute
specifically does not allow for probation.
Well,
how is that the court reading the statute and the statute does not allow for probation? How does that meet the court legislating that?
I think you have to look at 706-605. That's the general statute the legislature gave the power of courts across the land, that it could give probation. And I think when a legislature wants to amend that general statute, they must be clear and specific. I think that's the general rule that the court should follow. And
aren't the DLNR statutes the more specific statutes as opposed to the 706-600 statutes?
Well, I have to say that it's an agency promulgation of some rules, okay, that the legislature basically signs off on. So I can't say that.
Well, I mean, you're saying the legislature's not thinking. They just sign off. You can't say that. They pass and enact a statute.
I would, in looking at the fishing statutes and the agencies and the HRRs, I think the legislature gives deference to the administrative agencies. But when it's inconsistent with a general proposition or a general law that the legislature has passed, I think the legislature must be clear and specific, like the DUI statute that you says you can't get probation. And for that, the legislature is clear. For DUI back in the 90s, you cannot get probation. Dannenberg, when the legislature was clear and said, notwithstanding any contrary law, any law to the contrary, you shall be sentenced, etc. Now, interestingly, after the, this court handed down Dannenberg, the legislature took away that notwithstanding part of the prostitution statute and made it very clear that it's dankable. So I'd ask the court that...
That didn't happen here, right? So Amelia's been the law for 20 years and the legislature hasn't.
Right, and that gives me hope that the legislature was never clearly took it away from the general proposition of 706.605.
But Homina said it didn't apply. So if the legislature meant for it, I think that obviously that's what the CJ meant, that if this legislature meant for it to be a probationable offense, wouldn't it have responded to Homina?
I don't think you should put, or I put it this way. I think Hamili went beyond bounds of just being a judicial body to interpret legislation.
As you point out, the legislature hasn't hesitated to jump in.
Yes, but in...
Danbury jumped in. And
that is true.
And it didn't do so here.
Well, you know, I don't know what moves politically legislature, but when you have a general statute...
Actually, can you... go further in terms of the general statute. 706.600 says, no sentence shall be imposed otherwise than in accordance with this chapter. And the legislature's commentary to that general statute says, this section establishes that dispositions for all offenses, whether defined within or outside of the penal code, are to be imposed in accordance with this chapter. And the next paragraph talks about the penal code in centralizing provisions relating to the disposition of convicted defendants in one chapter differs from previous law, la-di-da, la-di-da. The last paragraph, by centralizing sentencing, the code seeks to achieve an internal consistency which is lacking under previous law. It appears, can an argument be made that the legislature did not have to speak any further because they had already spoken through 706.600, that 706.600 was supposed to control, that chapter was supposed to control sentencing. And when you look at 706.605, as you say, it says you can impose probation pursuant to Part 2, and Part 2 706.620 describes which crimes are non-probationable. And it says, it lists the crimes that the legislature considers non-probationable.
Six of them.
Yes, and these offenses are not included.
Right, and so that's why I think when the court wants to interpret the intent of the legislature, I think when you have a general statute that encompasses like the 706 Your Honor pointed to, to be clear, they need to create particularly a statute to get it out of the general application, like they did in the DUI statute, like they subsequently did on the prostitution. And absent that, I ask this court that you can't legislate as Hamili Court did 20 years ago. And that's, I guess, having
to go there. And the statute at issue, Hamili cited to Tom and Dannenberg. Tom was very clear. The offense 291.4 was, it's said in the statute, it's non-probationable. The legislature spoke specifically. And as you indicate in Dannenberg, it said, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary. But Hamili didn't have that language. So I agree with you that in order to find this offense probationable, Hamili would have to be overruled.
Can I respond to that? Mr. Lilly, the issue that Justice McKenna brings up, this idea that Hamili would have to be overruled, I wanted to ask your thoughts about the relationship between the sentencing statute here, 183D5, and the sentencing statute that you've been focusing on in Chapter 706, because as you point out, Chapter 706 makes available for a petty misdemeanor probation, correct?
Yes.
And here we're looking at 183D5, the provision that pertains to this particular case in terms of wildlife violations, that talks about first conviction by a mandatory fine of not less than $100 or imprisonment of not more than 30 days or both. Now, the compliance with the intent of the legislature in 183D5 is clearly laid out here, that a sentence would include a mandatory fine or imprisonment of 30 days. Why is that necessarily in conflict with 706? In other words, in this case, was the sentence in conflict? Was there a fine of $100 imposed?
I can't recall if the court imposed the fine, but
I think a fine was imposed.
Was imposed, but she did give probation as basically permitted.
Yeah, I understand, right. But I'm just suggesting that where a sentence is imposed of probation, for example, or no contest plea is granted, well, as long as there's a fine of $100 or there's imprisonment of 30 days or more as part of the sentence, why wouldn't that be consistent with 183D5?
I don't read 183D5 as being inconsistent with 706-605. And obviously the trial courts didn't and basically imposed probation for a period. So to read Hamili in the context, which I probably have to say no one briefed Hamili as the general application of 706-605. We just kind of got stuck on Dannenberg, got stuck on Tom, and the fear that somehow accused person would escape the first offense and never have to, you know, always get dankable for the rest of their life, which I think is kind of absurd.
To what extent does the rule... I'm sorry, Justice Paul?
Well, actually, the argument is shall I say, interesting, because that would also apply for all repeat offender offenses. In other words, if you got a DAG for a theft in the second degree, which is, you know, felony, you could say, oh, well, if you give a DAG to somebody with a Class B or C felony, you know, you can't do that because on the second time around, they won't be subject to the repeat offender, the enhanced sentencing. I have a lot of trouble grasping that argument with an enhanced fine that's going to theoretically deprive you from a DAG, because if you come through and as a statute, and plus you're not even allowed another deferral for another felony. So it's just a very argument that's difficult for me to grasp.
I agree with you, Your Honor. And yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you
I
look
know
at
that's a question, but you can.
as you read the Dank statute, it does exclude inapplicable for those situations, for repeat offenders. So here we have the legislature clearly outlined in the DAG statute 853 a whole bunch of inapplicabilities as to why Dank should not apply. All right? One of them is non-probationable. But you look at what my client was convicted of and sentenced to, I believe it is probationable, but for Hamili. And I suggest it's time
Can
to
go in a different direction right now?
Yes.
This is a case where you move for a DANC. The state did not oppose it. The court imposed probation. Nobody argued that probation wasn't available.
That's correct, Your
Honor. And the court did it, and everybody just walked away. Nobody informed the court that it wasn't a probational offense. So at this point in time, we're looking at plain error. Does this fit under the parameters of plain error?
I would say yes, Your Honor, and that is because it substantially impacts upon a substantial right.
Well, if
of
we
the client.
Don't recognize plain error, then you're not willing to go with a your client just getting probation.
I think he's been denied such a opportunity under the statute that denying him in this manner was a denial of due process.
If the court decides that this is not a probational offense, then playing this out, then when your client pled, he wasn't fully informed of the consequences. So wouldn't it be possible at that, or maybe mandated, that the whole plea deal be set aside, and then your client might be, it might be, and considering that that you had to move to have the
right.
deal, the court to enforce the deal,
right. Right.
Isn't this a possibility that it would place your client in a worse position because he wouldn't have the, because the deal wasn't, the plea wasn't fully informed and it would be set aside, then couldn't he then be prosecuted for a felony?
Right, Your Honor, and I have to say, it would, but for my friend and colleague, Mr. Hanano, raising it on appeal to the ICA, no one saw it. And frankly, I didn't. And if it's plain error for ineffectiveness, then basically I've demonstrated that. Okay? But when you look at the record that we were litigating, okay, the Second Amendment as to the place to keep statute as a matter of law, frankly, is suspect. And looking at the application of the place to keep, the facts are he arguably there is no probable cause that he even committed an offense.
So you're saying that plain error does apply?
I'd say that if the court wants to do justice and wants to find that you want to set aside the plea and find that I was ineffective for not advising my client as to the consequences of pleading and asking for, you know, a dank, and if the plea is set aside, he's going to be facing a Class C felony, well, I'll just have to fall on that sword because that's what happened because no one saw what was occurring, that it wasn't, I didn't see that this was not a dankable offense.
Mr. Lulli, I think you should move on
sure.
to whether, assuming you're correct, that this is dankable, I think you need to address the second
Thank
argument.
You. I think that the facts are clear that a 23-year-old youth with no criminal record, that he was eligible for this offense. What causes me concern is the trial court's concern that he didn't fess up and was still maintaining his innocence, that he was telling half-truths, that he's wearing camouflage clothing, that he had a headlamp and he had a rifle in his truck. And I feel that those are all coming really close, if not over, the line in Kamanao, that but for his insistence on claiming his innocence and the comments of arguably the court wanting him to fess up, not tell health half-truths, it appears that he should have received the dank.
Doesn't it? It almost appeared that the only way he could have responded to the court, because the court was asking about a statement that he had made to the police officer, the only way he could have responded was to give up his no contest plea, which was his right. The court had accepted a no contest plea, but then, because he was unwilling to respond, or did not respond to what occurred, therefore he was, it appears to have been disadvantaged by the court by his lack of response.
Didn't he respond though?
He responded, he said,
sorry.
You know,
at
sentencing,
he's
sorry for getting into this mess, something like that.
Yeah, okay? And you're not going to see me here again, I can
right.
guarantee that.
Right. And,
so
and,
he did say he was sorry.
Yes, and so that's why I think, you know, as far as an abuse of discretion, clearly the court disregarded logic,
Mr.
the substantial detriment of my client.
I just wanted to be clear, Justice Nakayama was asking you your position with respect to the I guess, the factual response of the defendant in this case and how you analyze that. Let me ask you, if he had responded, I'm sorry, yes, I don't want to contest this and it looks as though that's all I can say. I don't want to, in other words, he doesn't contend that he actually was not guilty and didn't have the intent. He says, look, I just want to approach this as a no contest plea. I'm not going to contest it. Do you think under those circumstances, if the judge had decided to deny the request for a deferral, that it would have been an appropriate exercise of discretion?
I'd say no. And the reason is it's petty
misdemeanor. Well, then what if he actually admitted it and said, I'm sorry, I did violate the statute. At this time, would like to ask for a deferral, and then she denied it. Would you say that was an abuse of discretion on this record? She was bound to grant the deferral?
Yes, I would, given the particular facts of this case.
So under the facts of this case, in your view, she had no discretion. She had to grant the deferral, regardless of whether the defendant were to admit the facts.
I think under the facts of this case, it's really clear the legislature wanted to give people like Mr. Medeiros the opportunity to receive the benefit.
Yeah, to finish the point, it looks like she talked about some facts other than his resistance in admitting the offense, right? She was talking about the fact that it looked like he was hunting. Didn't look like he was just driving around checking the area for the next morning. It looked like he was hunting because he had a rifle and he also had camouflage clothing on. And in it, their story didn't quite match up about the direction he was driving in, because at least when he was stopped, it didn't look like he was on his way to Hana. So it seemed to me there were some facts in which she seemed to feel that actually he may well have been hunting, and for whatever reason, she exercised her discretion in that regard.
Didn't she indicate that she took those facts, which was a social dismission, as an indicator that, or the likelihood he would reoffend? He's somebody who, I think the inference appears to be, or where she appears to be going, had perhaps done this before, was sophisticated in what he was doing, and for those reasons, she believed he might reoffend.
I'd say that could apply to any person who appears before the court and does not contest the facts as alleged by the government. And then that would, in effect, nullify a person from receiving by not contesting the facts.
But isn't it possible that you have youthful offender, sort of a one-time, first-time indiscretion, and I think she seems to be trying to suggest that this might be somebody who perhaps knew exactly what he was doing, done it before, and in her view was like, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that she seemed to think, given the circumstances, there was a basis to find he might be out there again unless he had a more significant sanction.
I think the real, as I take from litigating this case, I think it was her veiled concern of him not fessing up, and he insisted on his innocence because he litigated the reasonableness of the stop. He litigated that his whole stop was not based on reasonable, articulable suspicions, and also he had a defense on the place to keep. And that I felt the trial court used his position against them to his substantial detriment.
Do you think it was relevant? Isn't it true that the rifle was not loaded?
Absolutely, not loaded.
Was it relevant then that the ammunition was in, I think, the cup holder? And so the gun wasn't loaded.
It wasn't loaded. There was no shots being fired. Everybody agreed that using a headlamp, right, is perfectly legal. There has to be some coupling of a headlamp and a rifle to pursue, to kill. And there was nothing here. It is really, I think this case should have been decided that there's lack of reasonable suspicion and everything should have been thrown out. And that's, well, he didn't litigate because he lost and he went for the deferral.
What does scoping mean?
Scoping?
Your client said, I was scoping. Didn't he say that?
You know, from what I gather, it's looking, all right? Hunters can go out to an area, see if the herd's in an area, okay, and come back the next day. I mean, I live up in Kula, and just yesterday there was a deer in my driveway. Okay, so that means the herd's around there. We've been hearing them for the nights. So there's going to be some herd in an area the next morning. So the whole concept of he must have been hunting because he had a headlamp, he got a shirt from Costco or wherever, he had a rifle in his car, I think those were baseless. I mean, I think they were used against my client to his detriment.
Anything further at this time?
Nothing further. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Hanna.
May it please the court, Peter Hanna on behalf of the State of Hawaii. You have to excuse me, I'm kind of getting over a flu, so if I start coughing or my voice starts cracking. So it sounds like the court is interested in the Hamid issue, so I'm just going to cut to that. I disagree with petitioner's interpretation of Hamidi. I think Hamidi is very narrow. It only applies to that statute and others that are similarly worded. It has nothing to do with the enhancement of the penalties, and it says that in the case, that it has nothing to do with that because we find that there is none here.
I'm sorry, I don't know. What is that argument again that you just made?
Mr. Aluli mentioned something about the reason why, you know, Hamidi should be overturned, and he went into this issue about the repeat offender, the enhanced penalties upon second conviction, and if you give a dang for the first, then you can't enhance the second one because you gave a dang for the first one. That's not the situation in Hamidi because they explicitly found that there is no enhanced type of provision in...
The state never took the position that this was not dankable before
no,
the trial
not.
Court,
no.
Right? So you just raise it on appeal.
Exactly, yeah.
So before the trial court...
I don't know why it wasn't raised.
This was a little bit unusual. You know, this was pretty good plea deal.
Right.
It sounds like, you know, there was the state understood that the defense was going to be moving for a dank. It was mentioned in the plea document, and you stipulated that there wasn't even going to be a PSI.
Right.
Right? So the state understood that there was going to be a dank plea motion, and the motion was filed.
Right.
The state filed no opposition.
That's correct.
And on appeal, you argue that it's not dankable.
That's correct, because I felt that when I did the appeal, I had to at least alert the court to what the law was.
And do you think Hamidi was correctly decided?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, and based on, and you agree, you acknowledge that the language in Tom, the statute clearly said not probationable.
Right.
And Dannenberg said, notwithstanding
well,
any other
I'm not
law to the contrary.
Dannenberg and the other case, I don't know if that includes a situation where there's a mandatory enhanced penalty section or not. But the way the sentencing provision is written in the statute in Hamidi.
Hamidi is very clear. It was an enhanced sentencing situation.
It was not.
I'm sorry? It was. First conviction was 500.
Right, but the court found that there wasn't an enhanced provision. If you look at, paragraph 7, it says, as demonstrated, 188-70 does not contain an enhanced sentencing scheme for repeat offenders. And then they went on to look at the language of the statute and said that because the statute is very specific as to what's allowed and what's not, then that's all you can do. And I think that's what they based it on. It wasn't based on the fact that it's an enhanced sentencing statute, and if you give the dank on the first one, you can't.
Well, actually, it didn't say, the statute, of course, doesn't say that probation in the Hamidi case wasn't allowed. What it was it stated the jail term, which correlates to a petty misdemeanor. It was a petty misdemeanor.
Right.
And what that case essentially holds is that 706 doesn't apply because 706 specifically sets forth what are the allowable penalties for petty misdemeanors. And in fact, if you take this, the whole argument in Hamidi to the next step, which really gets even more concerning, is you're aware, I'm sure, that sometimes penalties aren't in the HRS, right? They're in administrative rules.
Right. Right? So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So a lot of times you'll have like environmental penalties, you know,
right.
Wildlife, all those things. So an agency can simply eliminate anybody from getting a deferral by just setting forth the penalties as, say, $100 or 30 days jail, just like the, you know, just... In other words, so agencies are given the authority, it sounds like to me, to trump the legislature who specifically wanted to allow first-time offenders to get deferrals. That seems kind of a little bit odd, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know if that's there's situations actually like that.
Well, let me give
the case here. Right, that's not the case here. I mean, this is an HRS statute. It's not a It's not a penalty. Right. But it refers to the HRS for the penalty section. So it's not a penalty section that's, pronounced by the agency.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is if the logic applies, then any time a penalty in the HAR is set forth, I'll give you an example. For example, 13-124-8, the penalties, this is a penalty, for example, for indigenous wildlife and dangerous threatened wildlife, things of that nature. And they use the same kind of language, you know, for a first conviction by a mandatory fine of not less than $100 or imprisonment of not more than 30 days or both. So that, in a sense, would allow the administrative agency to trump the legislature what it's done for deferral. That seems pretty something to me.
I mean, that's possible if, you know, the language... Yeah,
but is that necessary, Mr. Hanano? Is it necessary to find that the intent in 183D5 was to trump 706-600? Let me ask you about that. Isn't there a reading that would mean that there isn't a conflict? In other words, 183D5 was a reflection of legislative intent not to sort of amend 706-600 that makes it probation available for a petty misdemeanor, but just to make it clear that the penalty should include a $100 fine or imprisonment of not more than 30 days or both. Why not read it that way? Wouldn't that make
that's another reasonable interpretation as well.
And if to what extent do you think the rule of lenity would apply? In other words, that analysis would mean that not only would the statutes be consistent, but you'd be recognizing the idea that our discretion should be exercised with the understanding that the more lenient a sentence would be implied here. Somewhat like the Kasagay-Badion case, remember that? You had the conflict between the methamphetamine trafficking sentencing and the youth offender sentencing. And the court decided, even though there was language that said notwithstanding that pertained to the meth sentencing statute, the court still found that the youth offender would apply.
Well, then if that's the court interpretation, then you would, in effect, be overruling Hamili. I mean, that's what the effect is.
Well, potentially. I just wanted to see what your thought was about that legislative analysis, though.
But, you know, all I'm saying is this is the law as it stands today. I mean, I'm not...
You mean with respect to Hamili?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I wanted to inform the court of at least the case, because nobody brought it up.
Mr. Hanano.
Yes.
Speaking of which, nobody brought it up. And you don't really, in your briefs, you don't invoke plain error, but clearly you're invoking plain error, and Mr. Alili is joining you. But nobody brought it up, and the parameters for plain error usually are affect the substantial rights of the defendant. How can the court's invocation of a probationary period affect the substantial rights of the defendant when it left him eligible for a dank?
I understand what you're saying, Justice Nakayama, and I think that was the situation in State versus Kim Seol, I believe. And I think a case that came out after that was, this is by the Intermediate Court of Appeals, unpublished, State versus Andrews. Was kind of close to Kim Seol. It's an unpublished decision, 127 Hawaii 241. But in that case, they found that just by virtue of the fact that the defendant entered his plea not knowing that he was not eligible for a dang, does not make it fatal.
So if that applies here, what should happen? We conclude that that's the analysis that applies here. Should all be allowed to?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one option. The other option would be, maybe remanded back for hearing?
That was a factual determination where the defendant was not eligible for a plea based on facts. Here it's a misinterpretation of the law by all the parties involved.
Yeah.
It does not hurt the defendant. It doesn't affect his substantial rights, does it?
I don't know. I mean, if that's a good point. I mean, so.
I guess if he violated for his probation and he's sentenced to 30 days in jail,
he might be, his rights might be hurt. Yeah.
But you took the position that it wasn't an abuse of discretion, and in any event, because it's not dankable.
Well, that was. No, that's not.
Well, it wasn't dankable anyway, and it wasn't
right.
An abuse
that was
of discretion.
Right. And if I could get into that portion of it, the issue is basically whether the court was reasonable in denying the dank.
What about the argument that it seems like the fact that he was heading in the wrong direction and he was wearing camouflage clothing, that goes to the elements of the offense, not whether or not he's would be likely to commit the offense again.
Well, my response to that is.
Let me ask you one thing, and I'm going to
answer down first.
To respond. Can you argue today that he does not deserve a deferral when your prosecutor in court strongly, it seemed to me, said? Agreed with the defense that he was unlikely to commit a criminal offense. I'll let you answer the question and then go ahead and proceed.
Well, don't forget Justice Dacian.
Right, I'll answer hers first.
Answer both.
Okay, so let me rethink of what the question was. Okay, so I think the court, I know what I was going to say. In the defendant's motion for deferred acceptance of no contest plea, pretty much the only thing that he relied upon was the fact that allegedly there was no probable cause for the stop. That's it. Right? And if you look at...
I'm sorry, he attached letters, letters from, his father and basically,
Well, I'm talking about the motion itself and the memo, the argument was this should be granted because there's no PC.
That's his lawyer's fault then, right?
I don't want to point fingers, but that's what, what it is.
But the court relied on other things in denying the...
What I'm going to say is that was the focus, because that's what they were claiming, that he should get this done because there's no PC. Okay, when you look at the legislative history on why the deferrals were allowed to give, where the courts were allowed to give deferrals, is because, and I have it right here, the legislature finds and declares that in certain criminal cases, particularly those involving first-time accidental or situational offenders, it is in the best interest of the state and the defendant that the defendant be given the opportunity to keep his record free of a criminal conviction, especially where youth is involved, a record free of a felony conviction, which would foreclose certain educational, professional job opportunities, etc. We don't have any evidence of that.
The deputy prosecutor actually made a pretty good argument on the defendant's behalf as to why dank should be granted.
Well,
so to the extent that the defense attorney didn't make those arguments, your prosecutor did. Your office made great arguments as to why dank should be granted.
We didn't agree.
I have one more question. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And this is really bothering me.
Okay.
You take the position that this is not dankable because it's not probationable, right? Yet you don't argue that the probation sentence was illegal.
Well, that's kind of in effect what I'm saying.
Did you say the sentence should be set aside because it's an illegal sentence?
No.
I mean, if it's an illegal sentence, it needs to be set aside, right?
Yeah.
We don't allow illegal sentences, right?
Right. Or, so, that portion of the sentence can be struck.
So the state's now arguing that the probation should be set aside and only the fine should stand.
The fine and then the denial of the dank, that should be affirmed, and just strike the
But you can't
probation.
Do that. I mean, Justice
McKinney
is saying, if you, because a judge placed him on probation, so the sentence is illegal.
That portion of it.
If in fact, your present argument is correct, that it's non-deferrable because it's non-probationable. In other words, no probation. We're removing from the court the authority to monitor people for, say, 6 months or whatever the court wants to impose and impose conditions. We're allowing a deferral statute, an interpretation, to dictate a court's authority in imposing sentence, which, again, to me, seems quite a stretch.
Well, I think it's the statute and the case law that's dictating the court's authority. I don't think it's the
I agree with you.
I mean, that's where I'm coming from. I didn't make this up. I'm just following the law. I'm relying on the law. State versus Hamili has never been overturned, right?
You're correct.
And so if you guys feel it doesn't apply, it doesn't apply. I mean,
what's your response to Mr. Lilly's argument that this is simply penalizing him for all the things that just go into committing this offense? Except your argument, anyone could be denied a bank because basically the record shows he committed the offense, and because of that, the court said no bank.
And on that point, I don't think the court penalized him for not fessing up at sentencing. I mean, clearly there's nothing in the record that she said that. Like, you're not showing remorse right now. You're not admitting, so I'm going to deny your debt. There's nothing in the record like that. What we have, and basically the prosecutor basically said the same thing. She pointed out all these things that were inconsistent, although she did say he was honest because he did say he had a gun, but he was dishonest in other situations, lack of candor. That's one of the factors.
But that was when he got caught with the offense,
right?
I mean, generally speaking, people tend to kind of
lie.
deny when they first get caught.
Well, deny versus lie is two different things.
You have no evidence that he hasn't, afterwards, that he's not remorseful. There's nothing in the record showing that he's not remorseful. He says he's sorry. He won't do it again.
I think it's this whole thing about the whole reliance of the part, the thing that there was no PC. I mean, that was their position, that the bank should be granted because there's no PC. So the court was just going back there and addressing those concerns.
Mr. Hanano, while you're focusing on what the court's analysis of the facts was, can you help me with your view about what supported her position that the defendant is likely to again engage in such criminal course of conduct? Because before she said that, she referred to the facts having to do with what he was wearing and also that this occurred at night from 8:30 to 9, which is definitely within the time period for hunting hours. So, I mean, the Chief Justice was alluding to this concept that if the facts could be interpreted to mean that a crime occurred, and that's the reason to find that the defendant's likely to do it again, wouldn't that sort of disqualify all defendants who are engaging in conduct where they plead guilty or enter a deferral that could be interpreted to mean that they were guilty?
I don't think that's what happened here.
Okay, can you explain what was the basis for her finding to engage in criminal conduct?
Again, the whole motion of the deferred acceptance that was filed by the defendant was because there's no PC. So she's just putting on the record what she felt was PC.
Probable cause, fine. But what was the reason she found that he was going to engage in the criminal course of conduct again?
If I may, explain myself. First of all, he wasn't honest with what he was doing. I mean, they make a big argument about, he wasn't hunting. Come on. I mean, I've been hunting since I was 15 or 16. I mean, before that. We know that hunting and fishing does not mean catching.
Okay.
Just because you don't have something right in front of you doesn't mean that you're not hunting.
Okay, but
Then that means that, if you're hunting in the hunting grounds and you don't see anything, you don't need a hunting license.
Read you the statement that the prosecutor made that day? Because,
What's
again,
that?
I'm having trouble with your... with you taking a different position because you said...
I'm not...
So you know Mr. Medeiros was honest with the DLNR officers that night. He was honest. Maybe he didn't know the law. That's what your prosecutor said. So it's really difficult for me to hear you make this whole different argument.
Right, and I pull forward from that. He says your office argued.
Yeah,
He's young. He's 23 years old. He's never been in trouble before. He's never been arrested before. I think this has been a huge learning experience for him. I don't think we'll see him in the courtroom again. He definitely has support from his family. I think his parents have been here with him every time in court. Mr. Medeiros Sr. wrote a letter explaining the situation. Perhaps this was a misunderstanding and that the Medeiros family didn't quite know the law and understand the law. I think by this point they do. And so I'm comfortable that this was a learning experience for Mr. Medeiros. I don't think he will be back in court again. And so with regard to the request for deferral, I'll defer to the court on that. How can you now take the position that he was likely to reoffend and the interest of justice, that it was not an abuse of discretion based on how you argued this to the trial court?
Well,
how can you take this position?
I think prior to that, you need to back up and look what happened before that, where she was basically outlining where he was not.
He was not being sentenced for lying. He was not being sentenced for perjury.
But he was not
being sentenced for not admitting the offense.
But that violates
kamanao, right?
To sentence him for not admitting
the offense is a violation of
kamanao. But can the sentencing court take that into consideration, that the person is a liar? Is that not, like, valid
kamanao
consideration?
Kamanao is pretty clear that if you... a sentence is based on the defendant not admitting to the offense.
That's
a violation.
This was
a dank plea, not a DAG plea.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying based on the prior situation with, you know, at the scene.
Isn't the appropriate remedy to charge him with perjury then at that time? That's a separate offense.
No, because that's not a...
He's being charged. He's being sentenced for a separate offense
here. No, he's not under oath.
The motion to suppress wasn't... I thought there was a motion to suppress.
I don't think he testified.
He didn't testify.
He did?
He did, right?
I don't think so.
Why isn't that perjury?
Did he testify?
If he lied.
I don't think he testified.
He didn't testify.
He did not testify.
Okay.
No.
Mr. Hanano.
Yes.
In all fairness, we're not asking... When the judges were asking you about... we weren't asking you to change your position. Our questions were, how can you justify the judge... I think what Mr. Justice Wilson was saying was, how can you justify the judge's determination that he was likely to commit a further offense?
Well, I think you got to look at, you know, the totality of the circumstances. Number one, you know, Mr. Aluli keeps characterizing him as a youthful first-time criminal offender. Well, he's 23 years old. Is that youthful? I don't know. Maybe
that's even more to his...
I don't know because if you look at under 706667, young adult defendant is defined as someone who's less than 22. So I'm just saying there's something in the law that, you know, kind of defines what that is.
Well, Mr. Hanano, you went through the factors that a court is supposed to take into consideration in determining whether the person receives a dank, and one of them is he hasn't committed a felony. Mr. Medeiros hasn't even committed an offense, and he's 23 years old. How could the court How did the court come to this conclusion that he's likely to commit another offense? And this is only a petty misdemeanor, for goodness sakes.
I think it's based on the facts and circumstances of the crime and based on his lack of candor would be what? Because he said he was, you know, going home and he was facing the other way. He said he wasn't hunting. He had everything. I mean, the only thing he was missing was the wild game. I mean, he had the bullets, he had the gun, he had the camouflage, he had the light.
And then when he went to court and said he was sorry and the court would never see him again, doesn't that count?
That definitely counts. But, I mean, is this an unreasonable decision by the trial court? That's the question. Is it objectively unreasonable? Would any other judge have denied the dank? If the answer is no, then it's not an abuse of discretion.
I'm not so sure that that's the definition.
That is.
That's the standard.
That's part of it. I mean, that's right. Is an abuse of discretion
so
basically
we're supposed to
that?
Count up here and figure out how many of us would.
Exactly.
I don't know what you're doing.
And that's what the IC is saying, basically. You know, although we kind of, they kind of said, although we kind of disagree with it, right? Reasonable minds can, they didn't say reasonable minds can differ, but that's what they're saying. And that's what it is. Because in a recent case that Chief Justice Rechtenwald wrote, State versus Pisani or Pisini, he mentioned that about reasonable minds can differ. And that went into an analysis of whether or not there was an abuse of discretion committed, you know, where you got, you know, it could have gone either way. I mean, if no judge would have denied the bank, then it's an abuse of discretion. We're not saying that that's the case. That's all I have. Thank you.
Just quickly, the doctrine of judicial estoppel should apply where a party litigant blows hot and cold in litigation. And so that is accepted doction.
Even though the argument was made at sentencing and the judge rules a different way, at that point the state cannot advance arguments to support the sentence.
Not when it's totally inconsistent of what another party litigant, well, another deputy prosecutor said on the record. It seems to me that's, frankly, it should be a stop under the doctrine of judicial estoppel. Getting back to the general applicability of the sentencing court's ability to place a defendant on probation 706-605, that was passed in 1972. The administrative rules governing what's at stake here was passed in 1985. So it seems to me that if you have a general statute that applies generally, if there's going to be any exception to that general, there must be clear and specific language from the legislature making it absolutely clear that it's accepted from the general applicability. There is none here. The only real case or obstacle that's presented to the court is Hamili. And just reading from the language, the court said, as demonstrated, HRS 188-70, that's the Gilmetting administrative rule, does not contain an enhanced sentencing scheme for repeat offenders. Nevertheless, it still appears that a dank plea is unavailable for persons convicted of violating Gilmet. Just appears. And looking at the logic of the Hamili case and just the reaching out with this language further on the paragraph, because the sentencing court is limited to the alternatives expressly enumerated in HRS 188-70, and probation is not an enumerated alternative, the offense to which the sentence imposed is non-probationable. Then they go to the dank statute and says it's ineligible. I think it's time that Hamili needs to be reconsidered and looked at, because there's no discussion about 706, 605, or 706-620, which was passed way back in the 70s, and the statute that my client was sentenced under has no language saying, notwithstanding any contrary law, or particularly saying it's non-probationable like the DUI statute. I think it's time to revisit the meeting.
And just to be clear, I'm sorry, TJ. Just to be clear, you feel as a matter of law this judge was bound to give a dank?
I think it's as a matter of fact and law and the policy considerations, given the age of my client, his lack of criminal record.
Well, I mean, that does answer my question. So when she took the bench, basically she was locked in your view. She had to grant a deferral.
I think the court should find that it was an abuse, given the facts of this case, because she disregarded the usual practice and well-established principles of law. And the last thing I want to say is
she disregarded in the sense that, are you saying that she implied that she didn't admit what was wrong? Or are you saying under any set of circumstances?
I think the facts of his youthfulness, his lack of criminal record, and using his not fessing up, not addressing her concerns that he was not saying he was hunting, because it wasn't.
I think I just wanted to be clear. We've gone down that road, and right. in your view, that isn't critical to your analysis. It didn't matter whether she was relying upon him not admitting to the offense. In your view, even if he admitted to it, she was locked in. She had to give a deferral.
I think if he admitted to the offense, I think her concerns would be misplaced. And frankly, I think the
because if he admitted to the offense, you would think that maybe that would be even more of an indication she should grant the deferral, right? Because he's taking responsibility.
Yes, but I think that the legislature amended the Dank statute.
Because the legislature didn't seem to. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just trying to understand your point of view. The legislature didn't seem to design the statute to require a judge to give a deferral as a matter of law where there's no prior criminal history and where the defendant admits it.
I think the legislature made clear, even before 1972, that this was a benefit, and society wanted accused persons for the benefit.
I don't disagree with you. It was a benefit. It appears to have set it up for the judge's discretion. We can agree with that.
Okay.
I don't really think I need to ask you the question, but it's clear, in your view, there was no way she could apply the provision of the statute that allows for jail.
That's correct. Because the statute didn't apply for that.
Mr. Lilly, your yes. position is not, I understand, that when the judge walked in, she was required to give a deferral. In fact, your position is based on what was presented to her at that time in the proceeding, which depended based upon what information she was given, which included what the state had said and what wasn't said and what wasn't introduced, that the court abused its discretion based on the record before.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you for summing it up to me. I really appreciate it.
I do have yes. just a final question. So what if this court were to find that this offense was probationable and therefore dankable, what relief are you requesting?
Thank you. I think the relief should be reversing the ICA and a remand to the circuit court with instructions to grant the deferral, because it's clear in my view all the policy of the legislature and the facts that were presented that Mr. Medeiros is entitled to.
And this probation sentence has been stayed pending this appeal, right?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolo kolo kie kie hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.